Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Religious liberty has been called the first freedom. Not only is the freedom to worship as one pleases enshrined in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, but the ability to think freely about the fundamental question defining one's own existence and to worship with others with similar views without interference form the basis of all other liberties. If we do not have the freedom to control our own thoughts, could we really be said to have freedom in any other area? Most governments, on paper at least, agree that religious liberty is of fundamental importance. Nearly all national constitutions contain some statement guaranteeing such freedoms. However, what is written on paper is not always put into practice. Violations of religious freedom and outright religious persecution, sometimes manifesting itself in severe violence, happen daily in every part of the world. To discuss how common this problem is and why it occurs, I am pleased to be joined today by Professor Roger Finke, who along with his co-author Brian Grimm recently penned perhaps the most comprehensive study of religious persecution around the globe to date. The title of the book is The Price of Freedom Denied: Religious Persecution and Conflict in the 21st Century. Professor Finke is a professor of sociology and religious studies at Penn State University and director of the Association of Religion Data Archives, which we've talked about before on a previous podcast with Chris Bader, and if we get a chance, we'll talk a little bit about that again at the end of our show today. Roger, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Great. I want to start off with what may be a seemingly obvious question to answer, but I nonetheless still think it's pretty important, and that is the question: is why religious liberty and/or religious persecution is so important. And I'm saying that not necessarily thinking about large-scale persecutions. I think we'd all agree that blowing up a mosque during a worship service or driving hundreds of Christians from their homes in some village somewhere would really register as an unacceptable state affair and lead to social chaos. But I'm more thinking about the other forms of persecution or harassment that might go unnoticed by us and that we might think to be more benign. For instance, a local government might rescind the building permit for some religious minority, or we might, that religious minority we might consider to be somewhat strange or odd, and so rescinding that building permit might help create social peace. But nonetheless, that's a violation of religious liberty. Or, you know, another example of this I was just thinking, too, is that we may be willing to tolerate restrictions on missionaries in other country because, well, you know, those Christian missionaries, they shouldn't really be tampering around with somebody else's culture anyways. So the big question here is, why is this issue of religious liberty or religious persecution so important? And I think that ties into the title of your book, too, The Price of Freedom Denied. In a, what gave the title of that book, and why does this stuff matter at all?
Yeah, well, I think there's a few things going on here. I mean, one is people always have to remember that anyone else's freedoms are also my freedoms. So I might not like a religious group or what they stand for, what they believe in, but their freedoms are my freedoms. And also, freedom of religion, both in the form of expression as well as assembly, get at the very things as at the heart of other civil liberties, such as freedom of speech, freedom to assemble. These are at the heart of many other freedoms and liberties as well. And what we found was that quite often people view the denial of these religious freedoms as something that actually will lead to a greater peace, that it's something that can come at a fairly low cost because the majority of people don't mind if you regulate or restrict the freedoms of Jehovah's Witnesses or Baha'i or maybe some Pentecostal groups. But what we found was that in the long term, the price of denying those freedoms is really quite high indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only is it bundled with a package of other civil liberties, which we tend to prize very highly, but also we found that it consistently was associated with far higher levels of conflict between the groups, of levels of religious violence, And so denying those freedoms, while initially seeming to be done to preserve the peace, actually have quite the opposite effect.
Yeah, that it augments later conflict down the road, and restricting the freedom of that one strange group over there eventually leads down a slippery slope, perhaps, to restricting my own freedoms.
It clearly does. Yeah. And as a result of restricting some of those groups in an attempt to better control them, or that is certainly the view, it often actually results in far greater tensions between that group and the larger culture, but also between groups that are even somewhat sympathetic to that group and the larger culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you start restricting what you can say in terms of your religious beliefs, it's only one more step to say restricting in terms of a lot of other beliefs as well. Or once you restrict their ability to assemble to worship, it starts restricting groups' ability to assemble for many other reasons as well. And so we found that it starts off with a fairly narrow definition, but because it's so vaguely defined, it soon spreads far beyond that.
Yeah, what you did with this book in documenting all these different types of restrictions, big and small, is quite an amazing task. In fact, both you and Brian, as I mentioned in the introduction here, probably have gathered the most comprehensive data set on this issue. And I would also throw Jonathan Fox in there as well. He's performed a similar task. So you guys are, I would say, in the all-star league of academic studies of religious freedom for just the sheer empirical task of what you did. And both of you guys then come up with some great theoretical explanations for why this is going on. But that task itself of just gathering this information must have been immensely difficult. Could you tell us a little bit about the process of how you went about figuring out where religious persecution is in the world and how prevalent it is?
Certainly. Yes, it was something where when the International Religious Freedom Reports first came out, it was something that myself, Rod Stark, others thought that it, and I'm sure probably you yourself as well, Tony, thought that it would be a great thing to try to code it up.
Yeah, and that was about the year 1999 or so?
Yeah, 1998 was actually the very first year, and probably 1999 was when they were first released.
And this was via congressional, here in the United States, congressional mandate to gather this information, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And that mandate then required that each embassy would have representatives which would collect data using a wide variety of sources.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the years, those sources became more and more standardized in terms of the way they would report on all these various sources. So they would rely on official state support sources, but they would also rely on the press. They would rely on a lot of different agencies. They would rely on the local government. And as a result, they became by far the most complete reports we had by country. But they also became standardized in terms of what they reported. And the one thing they consistently reported on by mandate, as you mentioned, was religious freedom. So as a result, we had very detailed information for virtually every country, with the exception of the United States and then a couple countries where we did not have embassies. And then from that information, we simply then wrote up, and this is really where Brian took the lead with the collecting of the data, and we wrote up a survey instrument that he worked with other grad students who were at Penn State at the time, and they coded data for each of these different areas. So did the government restrict worship, religious worship? Did the government have a religious bureau which monitored the activities of religious groups? And you would go through, and we ended up with well over 100 different what we would call variables, but pieces of information that we gathered from those reports for every report for every country.
And it's a great task that you perform for academia at large, too, here, because previous to this, most of our knowledge of religious persecution was largely anecdotal, that it would come about, we saw something in the news, and usually those anecdotes from the news media tended to focus on very visible forms of religious persecution. So it seems that what you are doing through these reports and coding them is getting at some of the more subtle ways that religious liberty is violated and in which religious persecution occurs.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that occurred too is, as you said, for the media, they needed the picture to really make the story become real. But there were many groups, that, including Christian groups, Jewish groups, Islamic groups, which were reporting persecution, reporting a lack of freedoms around the globe. But with many of those groups, it was uncertain how accurate their reports were.
Right.
Because you feel that, these are advocacy groups. So you didn't know how much to trust them. What we found out was once we started coding was the level was actually even higher than what many of these groups were suggesting.
Mm-hmm.
So we were very startled by the level, the frequency, and the prevalence across the globe.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, the prevalence of this. Talking about where we find the highest levels of religious persecution as well as violations of religious liberty, what are your general findings in that area?
Well, I mean, the one finding, of course, is when it comes to even the physical abuse and displacement of people due to their religious beliefs, that even in that area, it occurs across the globe. So there's no region of the globe that's exempt. However, there are certain regions that are extremely high. The one which I think most people would predict right off is going to be South Asia, you know, with Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. The other countries which fill in that area, and Sri Lanka, Nepal, and Bangladesh. So that's an area where in every one of those countries, we found that more than 200 people had been either physically abused or displaced due to their religion in each of those countries.
Mm-hmm.
Another area that was very high was what people would commonly refer to as the Middle East. It's the Near East, North Africa is the way it broke down in our regional groups. But that was also quite high. You found this physical persecution occurring in all of those countries. The high levels of 200 or more occurred in 71% of those countries. So that was a high area. East Asia, here thinking of such as China, it was quite high there, not as high as these other two regions, but quite high there as well. The Western Hemisphere was lower than other regions, as we might expect. But it was not that it was completely absent. It was when compared to other regions, it looked quite good, but it certainly was not absent there.
So we're seeing this really in all four corners of the globe. What about those who are persecuted? Is there a pattern that you see of religious denominations or faith traditions that seem to be, or that seem to take the brunt of the persecution more than any others?
Yeah, there are some groups that get hit all the time. First, I should say, that all religious groups face some persecution. Some are persecuted in countries, in their home country. They persecute others, so they go somewhere else, and they're persecuted over there. So all religions face some persecution. However, the ones that you see consistently persecuted are Jehovah's Witnesses, Pentecostal Christians, and the Baha'i are three of the groups that are most heavily persecuted. And obviously, Jewish groups are still persecuted as well, but perhaps not as high as they once were.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Horowitz once described that he said if you go into the Middle Ages he said the Jews were the canaries in the coal mine. You knew that there were serious limitations on freedom in a society once they started persecuting Jews. Now it's more Pentecostal Christians, it's the Jehovah's Witnesses, these other groups, which they tend to be the very first ones to go. They're the ones that the first ones face the pressures.
Mm-hmm. I think that analogy that you used, the canary in the coal mine, really traces back to what you were saying about the importance of this topic, is that if you see violations of the rights of these quote-unquote fringe groups or strange groups first, there's this indication that later on down the road, the price that other groups are going to pay is going to be pretty high.
Tony, as you know from some of our other work too, is whenever minority groups are facing restrictions on how they can conduct worship, on how they can, whatever the services they can provide for their members, it greatly impinges on their ability to operate as organizations that can benefit the larger society as well as their ability to be successful as groups. So these minority groups, which seem so small now, can actually have play a very major role in a society's later. I mean, if you look at the United States, Catholics were once considered a dangerous foreign religion.
Mm-hmm.
Methodists were considered a dangerous sect. So each of these religions started off as minority religions that over time became the mainstream of what American religion is about, and that same type of trend has occurred in countries around the globe.
Let me ask you just to backtrack a little bit about the Baha'i faith, because I think most of our listening audience are familiar with the Christian traditions such as the Jehovah's Witnesses and Pentecostals and the Catholic Church, obviously. But the Baha'i faith, where is that located and what problems are they facing?
Yeah, with the Baha'i faith, some of the greatest problems they face would be in countries where they believe in the Prophet Muhammad, they believe in Jesus Christ, but then they believe in prophets that come beyond that, that go beyond those earlier prophets. And this is the very area that gets them into so many problems as far as, for example, Iran, where they had fairly sizable numbers, but have been openly persecuted, I mean physically persecuted, for many years there. The persecution isn't as extensive as perhaps the Jehovah's Witnesses across the globe, but they clearly face it because they are preaching about that the prophecies didn't end with Muhammad. They continued on thereafter, and that is a source of great concern when you're in a country such as Iran.
Yeah, considered a source of apostasy, which could lead to the unraveling of your own religion that you might be favoring.
Exactly.
There's one thing that you brought up in the chapter where you talked about the prevalence of religious violations of liberty, or excuse me, violations of religious liberty around the world. And that is when you started coding, and I did this as well when I had a grad student go around and say, look at all the constitutions and let's find out who has religious liberty or not.
Yeah.
That so many governments publicly acknowledge the right to worship as one pleases. But again, when we start looking at the details, that's really not quite the case. Why do you think it is that if a number of these governments are blatantly going to be violating a lot of these religious liberties, why do they put it in their statements, their constitutions, or even some of their most public pronunciations?
Yeah, well, I think there's a number of reasons involved. I mean, part of it is simply the definition that people give to freedom. You know, so when they say that there's freedom to worship, they mean that there's freedom to worship if you're an established religion who's been here a long time and you do it in the privacy where no one else can see you. So I think part of it is definition. Another part that enters in, too, is that some of these countries realize that with the UN Human Rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 18, in there they have strong statements about supporting religious freedom and also as far as the right to convert, the right to openly preach and to teach as far as your religious teachings. So as a result, there's a lot of global pressure for countries to put in some sort of clauses on religious freedom. And to the extent that they are embedded or wedded into this larger global network, I think that has a tremendous impact on the pressures they feel to at least state that they have those freedoms. One of the most dramatic examples was in 2006, when someone was in Afghanistan, they were threatening to kill as far as a someone who had converted from Islam as far as to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And the Associated Press in 2006 reported that Abdul Rahman was his name, that he was being persecuted. He's going to be charged with conversion, which was against the Constitution, and as a result, that he was going to be put to death. Well, the West just could not believe this, and everyone was in uproar over this. But when you look closer at the Constitution, what you find is that one clause sounds very much like Article 18, guaranteeing religious freedom, but the next clause says no law can be against the law of Islam. And it's not simply Islamic nations that have these contradictions. It's throughout many countries' constitutions. So on the one hand, they want to promise what's expected of them, but they have very different ideas of how, if at all, it's going to be implemented. And so country after country we'd find would have a guarantee of religious freedom in the Constitution, but they have numerous policies and restrictions which deny those freedoms.
Yeah. Let me ask you a little definitional issue here. It's a subtle one, but it becomes very important in your book and when we start to understand why these things occur or why these violations occur, why persecution occurs, this definitional issue becomes important. We've been talking about the violations of religious liberty and religious persecution as being one and the same, but are those things really similar? Do they have different sources from whence they come in society?
Yeah, we restrict religious persecution to simply mean any sort of physical abuse, so it could be anywhere from murder to physical assault, or physical displacement, so some sort of forced migration where people are forced out of their homes to move somewhere else. So any sort of physical abuse or physical displacement. And that's what we restrict religious persecution to.
Mm-hmm.
What we look at when we talk about religious freedom, so religious regulation, there we're talking about restrictions that might deny someone the freedom to worship openly, to build as far as a religious congregation to worship in, restrictions on expression of religious beliefs, or religious restrictions on the right to convert. All of those would be what we'd call restrictions on freedom or regulations, but they're not persecution. Some people would call those persecution. We say those are the restrictions, but what we found was consistently once they started restricting freedoms in those areas, that's the very thing that led to persecution and really larger conflict and violence as well, too. And again, the irony of much of this is so oftentimes those restrictions are put in place because countries view it's a way to effectively control, to calm down potential problems, mm-hmm. and in fact it has just the opposite effect.
Yeah, I'm interested in that divide that you brought here, but also show how they're intimately intertwined. My own work, I focus on violations of religious liberty or the establishment of religious liberty, which I tend to narrow down to a governmental issue, that this is
yeah.
a legal issue where the government writes the codes and then they can decide whether to enforce them or not. Religious persecution can come from a number of different sources. One, it
right.
could come from the government, but from social groups as well. And as you mentioned, those subtle signals that the government says, saying, well, this group really doesn't count as a religion, they're not to have a house of worship over here, sends signals to society at large saying, oh, have at these groups because we
yeah.
don't consider them as equal as other groups.
No, I think that's a real good point. That's the thing we found over and over. It's very similar to if people compared it to the South of the early 20th century
mm-hmm.
when lynchings of blacks were occurring and others, where people in the, as far as the legal authorities were often turning a blind eye to allowing persecution to occur of a minority group. In the same way, we see this all the time where in Russia, well, in Iran, in a whole host of different countries, we see where the government turns a blind eye to when certain other religious minorities have their churches burnt down or gunfire shot into there, or the ultimate as far as someone is actually killed, you know, as far as in that worship facility.
Well, let me back us up and talk about the issues of religious liberties being violated, because that's going to lead us on to the issue of religious persecutions here. And normally when we think about religious liberty, we think about that constitutional declaration. Do you have the freedom to worship unencumbered? And if that's in the Constitution, well, that's great. But as your book documents so well, and I'm imagine you saw this in the data as you're going through and coding it and looking at the different forms of it. These violations of religious liberty can take a whole host of different forms. So give us some idea of the range of these violations of religious liberty that governments can undertake.
Yeah, as far as the restrictions that they can place on go from being very, very subtle to very, very blatant. So it can be so subtle as simply they form religious bureaus,
mm-hmm.
and quite often these religious bureaus are intended as far as to sometimes do nothing more than simply register all the religious groups, which has very little impact on them. However, other times the restrictions can be where religious groups have to qualify to be registered. And so as a result, the bureau which registers these groups has a tremendous amount of power over whether a religious group is even going to be acknowledged by the state and is going to be allowed to exist and worship openly. So that's one of the most standard sources of restrictions, are simply these religious bureaus.
Yeah, I want to stop you there because that,
yeah.
in my own research, and this is going back, you know, 20, 22 years when I started doing work on Latin America, doing my field work down there, I was very surprised to see that a number of countries had ministries of religious affairs or ministries of the cult, as they would call them there, in culto in Spanish generally means faith tradition.
Yeah.
And for me as an American, that was very foreign. I said, well, where's ours? Do we have that? And no, we don't. And I started thinking a little bit deeper about this. And in one aspect of it, you can see it as a rather innocuous type of regulation or innocuous part of the government, because a lot of religious organizations qualify for tax-exempt status.
Right.
And
right.
So you need somebody to determine, well, what's this religion? Is it a really valid religion, or did somebody just make this up to get around paying taxes? And also there's some concern that religions that might be harmful to the public at large, some worship group that believes in human sacrifice, for example, might
right.
not be something we want to promote. So, yeah, it seems like a good idea to have a government official looking over what religions qualify for tax-exempt status or what ones should be legally recognized. But as you mentioned, once you open that door, there's a lot of different avenues in which you can tinker with rules about who qualifies and who doesn't, which can lead to a lot of violations of basic human rights or basic religious rights here.
That's right. And it can go from something as minor as just determining if they should be registered or not and using it in very capricious ways to sort of maintain control over these groups,
mm-hmm.
to something where they have the right to send people to re-education camps without going to court. And so they can go from very, very mild to really where they have absolutely no negative consequence or very little on the religious group themselves, to being ones that are always holding that group. It's a source of threatening that group, but that group has to behave in the way the state wants them to, or else they will lose their right to exist at all.
Yeah, the right to even just get a building permit, for instance.
Oh, yes, that's right. And you know, in many of these countries, if you do not have, you know, if you're not a registered group, then it restricts you from all sorts of rights, including the right of just public worship and being able to rent a group or rent a building.
Mm-hmm. So what other forms of violations of religious liberty have you come across in your empirical studies here?
Yeah, you know, it's remarkably creative. I mean, some of the restrictions, as you mentioned, aren't simply governmental. So some of the restrictions are more social restrictions, ones where there's strong pressure from the culture as a whole, or from simply selected religious groups. Again, if I take that example going back to the early 19th century, you had social movements such as the Ku Klux Klan, which, you know, strongly put pressure as far as on making sure that blacks remained, quote, in their place. In the same way, you see groups like these arising in countries such as India, but many other countries, where you have strong social movements vying for restrictions on some of these minority religious groups. So it can be groups such as in Iran, where, or I shouldn't say Iran, but in countries where you have one brand of Sharia law, where they would like to have a different, a stricter brand of Sharia law. Maybe perhaps Afghanistan, Pakistan would be a good example for that. But you have these same social movements which arise in Russia. You have these social movements which arise in India extensively, where they want to preserve their Hindu culture. And they're in sharp conflict with Christians and Muslims. So the way these arise can come from really multiple avenues as far as of sources.
One of the interesting things that you note is that a lot of the sources of the social pressure, which then translates into governmental regulation, come from churches themselves.
That's absolutely right.
And you give a really good example in the book discussing what went on in Russia during the 1990s with the collapse of Russia, the Soviet Union, in 1991, excuse me, up through 1997. Give us a little flavor of what went on there, because I think this really ties in the social pressures with the regulation of religion as well.
Yes, initially in 1990, you have what might be called just open religious freedom for many different groups, and you suddenly saw a large number of new religious groups arising. You saw groups such as the Salvation Army, Jehovah's Witnesses, a wide range of different evangelical Christian groups all coming into Russia, but throughout the former Soviet Union, and really showing some fairly, you know, rapid growth. But then you see this backlash which starts to occur, both from the Orthodox Church, but also from the government in a larger extent. And the Orthodox Church starts to form alliances with the existing governments, but to make that alliance, they also expect greater control of some of these minority sectarian groups. So by 1997, all of a sudden you see changes in the law, which now sort of have a two-tiered structure of religious groups. Those which are sort of the old-timers who've been around a long time and have greater freedoms, and then those that are on the second tier, And then there's a third tier that's not even mentioned, and those are the groups that aren't given the right to register at all. And when these policies came into place in 1999, there were 900 groups that initially had registered earlier, but they simply were dissolved. And what most people expect is it was simply because those groups knew that they would never receive the right to register again. And they already were facing the social pressures of some of the groups around them as far as where they had sort of gone underground again to worship more as they had in the past.
And this has a huge impact, having talked to a number of ministers and pastors around the country, this has a huge impact on missionary strategies.
Right.
Because in 1990, 1991, the floodgates were open for missionary activity in Russia. And by 1997, a lot of groups, as you mentioned, Pentecostal groups, Baptist groups, just throw up their hands and say, well, you know, how can we possibly really get a foothold in here? Let's go somewhere else. Let's go to Africa. So I don't think people really understand the significance of some of these even subtle restrictions on building codes and stuff that can force religiosity in a lot of different directions around the world.
Yeah, and there are certainly examples throughout Russia, too, of where people were openly persecuted or harassed in a variety of ways by groups around them, and again, it was an example of where the local legal officials would simply turn a blind eye to what was going on.
Right. One of the groups that you mentioned there was the Salvation Army, and we're recording this in mid-December here, and it will be airing at the end of December, beginning of January, and we think of the Salvation Army as the bell ringers. They're outside the mall with the bell. The Russian government looked at them a little bit differently, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. They took away the right to be a registered group there. And I think just recently did allow them to register, but they went almost 10 years as far as where they were not giving the privilege of being registered in Moscow, and actually in other areas of the country as well, too. So, yeah, and one of the things cited was that they were too military.
Yeah.
and because, as you know, as far as they have a very formal organizational structure, which is modeled after a military group, but they're also, I don't think anyone's really accused them of being military in terms of their actions otherwise.
No, they have the Salvation Armies listed in there, and I think they have ranks of captains and such like that. But, yeah, these aren't gun-toting missionaries that go around invading territory.
Yeah, and, you know, Tony, one other thing, too, that I find interesting is, as you said, sometimes it's the dominant religious group or the group that's sort of in power, a religious group that's in power, which tries to prevent these new minority sects and cults, and they want to get them out. And sometimes you have purely secular states which do it because they are concerned they're a threat to the state. So the motives for why these groups, why freedoms are often removed, can be very, very different. Some to control a religious power that's a religious group that's in power, and sometimes simply because they can threaten the state, even in very mild ways.
You mentioned that in France. I mean, we'll talk about China a little bit later, and that's a very obvious case for what you mentioned, that the state feels threatened by these religious groups. But in talking about Russia, in the same chapter that you do that, you mentioned France as well and their religious bureau. Tell us a little bit about what France does with their laws against cults.
Yeah, with France, I think one of the things, they have what they would call, you know, a separation of church and state as we do, but they would not have as high of the promises or guarantees of religious freedom are not as strong. So as a result, they want to make sure that there is no establishment of religion with the state. They want to make sure that the religion does not have too high of a public role as far as in the public arena. But one of the key things that really made all of this come to a head was when there was a religious cult named the Order of Solar Temple, and where they were suicides were committed. It was a large number of them in the group committed suicide. Shortly after that, France issued a commission to study this, and there was a real hysteria about how dangerous all of these cults and sects were. And they then issued a statement. There were 173 different religious groups they had identified as cults and sects that were dangerous that had to be closely monitored. Now, in those groups were groups that in the United States and throughout much of the world, Latin America, would be considered mild Pentecostal groups or mild Baptist or evangelical groups. and some of them not even that. So you have a large percentage of the groups simply being some version of evangelical in their name. And as a result, there were two things that happened here that were similar to what happened around the world. Was one, you had a very vague definition on what a cult or sect was. So they had long reports about the dangers of sects and cults, but never really defined what they were. The vague definitions they had could almost as well apply to a a France football team as it could to a religious group. And then the other thing was they gave their religious bureaus a broad discretionary powers in terms of deciding who it was as far as that should be labeled as a cult or a sect. And what this led to was really some open discrimination against a large number of minority groups. And it also resulted in greater tensions even with religion as a whole in that culture.
Mm-hmm. I know in some cases where the government really takes the initiative here, a number of the dominant churches actually come to the aid or support of some of the more minor religions as well. Because they see the issue of, well, if you start going after these minor religions, I guess I'm coming up next.
That's right. And that was the case in France as well, mm-hmm. where, the Catholic Church was often in opposition with many of these evangelical groups. They actually were defending their right as far as to speak out, defending their rights as far as to worship openly. And so that was the case there as well. It's interesting, even in one of the things when I was interviewing some Islamic imams here in the United States, one of the things they expressed interest but also appreciation in was that in the United States when they were struggling to try to buy space in a strip mall as far as to form a general Islamic center with a mosque in it, that it was some of the local clergy who came to their defense when a real estate company was refusing to sell to them. And they were very impressed. And again, it was that same sort of motto of their freedoms are my freedoms, so I'll defend them, completely. And I think in France we're even seeing more of that occurring now as well.
Yeah, that's a story that really goes unreported that I have found out. There's been a recent controversy, I believe it's in Memphis or Nashville, about a mosque that wants to be built, but the local government is restricting the construction of this. And a local Baptist church has actually opened their doors and say, hey, you want to come in here on Saturday and Friday, doors are open for you. And part of the story rarely gets reported. And it really hits your main point. Well, because, again, restrictions on, whoa, that strange group over there might seem benign at the moment, but down the road, that really leads to greater problems for everybody.
That's right. Even in 1990 in the U.S., when Smith versus Oregon case, where they decided that the law was formally neutral and generally applicable, could be applied to religion, that you didn't have to guarantee religious freedom great of extent has been interpreted in the past. And there was much controversy on how all of this should be interpreted and how the case was written up. But in the end, what several people pointed out was if a law can simply be generally applicable and formally neutral, and you are then going to be persecuting against a group which, a law attacks them maybe somewhat indirectly, the same could apply to many groups in the United States, such as Catholic or Lutheran groups, which have Holy Communion where children are allowed to drink wine during the service.
Mm-hmm.
The law against drinking alcoholic beverages by minors is formally neutral and is generally applicable, and so it could clearly be applied in this case. So there's a lot of laws that are even unintended in the consequences they have.
Yeah, the Smith v. Oregon case, for those not familiar with it, involved some people working at a drug rehab clinic who had used peyote as part of a Native American religious ceremony. They were denied unemployment benefits and went to sue. What was really fascinating and caught me off guard when that decision came before the Supreme Court was the coalition that came to support the legal rights. It was not only the ACLU, but it was Christian right and evangelical groups. You're saying, whoa, they're defending somebody who's using peyote, but it was this realization that, yeah, that's part of their religious ceremonies, and we have parts of our religious ceremonies that could be viewed by the state as strange and not necessarily used to fire or could be used to fire somebody in that regard.
That's right. The group that came to the defense of the Native Americans in that case was the most diverse religious group I think I've ever seen on any one document, because you had the what people might call the liberal denominations, but you also had a host of evangelical, much more conservative groups as well.
Let's move on to the question of why this all occurs. Your book is not merely an empirical documentation of the violation of human rights and the onset of religious persecution. It does that extremely well, but you also offer an explanation for why this is occurring. So, under what circumstances are religious rights violated?
A number of things. I mean, you know, actually, the main argument we have throughout the book is one where whenever these rights, as far as freedoms are removed, is greatly increases the chance for religious violence, mm-hmm. for religious persecution, for really a lot of conflict to occur. So we think that it's much more likely to occur. Borrowing some on your work as far as why these freedoms are actually taken away, sort of the first step in the equation, if you will, there are a number of reasons. You know, sometimes it's because the dominant religion views these minority religions as a threat. Sometimes it's because the state views these minority religions as a threat. Falun Gong in China was a good example of that. You have 10,000 members of their group coming out and standing in silence, you know, around Red Square, as far as to protest that they are not recognized as a legitimate spiritual group. Now, immediately following that, you know, you see all of this major persecution, large numbers being jailed, large numbers being detained, large numbers going to re-education camps. But clearly the reason that the state felt they needed to step in was because they viewed this as a threat, a direct opposition to a policy which they had.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the motivation can be as far as states making alliances with strong religious groups. And when they make those alliances with them, the strong religious group expects something in return. And that would be that they try to prevent all this other religious competition, these other religious groups. The other thing that also occurs is that, like any civil liberty or any of these human rights, they're very inconvenient. They're inconvenient for the majority. So as a result, allowing everyone to say anything they want and have free speech can be very inconvenient for the government in power. Allowing all these groups to assemble, you know, to meet as groups can be very inconvenient for the sources in power. And that same thing occurs as far as for religious groups as well, too, as far as to give them complete freedom, because religion has proved to be a very powerful motivator for groups and for individuals. So to give them this complete freedom is something which seems very threatening as far as to the state as a whole. Falun Gong seemed like a major threat to the Chinese government. Even though to us it seems like a very minor threat, Tibet seems like a major threat to the Chinese government. So in each case, these are things that people react very harshly. To bring it home to the U.S., there are certain groups which view Islam now to be a major threat and wanting more restrictions on Islamic groups. But fortunately, the majority of the groups are still saying they have the same freedoms we do. Their freedoms are our freedoms, and as a result, in the United States, there's far less conflict between Muslims and Christians in the U.S. as compared to countries where there has been restrictions placed on Muslims or restrictions placed on Christians, either way.
Yeah, including in Europe, too, which we don't recognize.
It's a very good example.
This really brings an important aspect of your book to the fore here. And you mentioned the term religious competition, or we could think of religious pluralism.
Yeah.
And you come up with what some might think is a somewhat counterintuitive finding. And I want to contrast this with Sam Huntington, which you discuss in the book. Sam Huntington wrote a book called The Clash of Civilizations, where it was largely believed that if you get two different worldviews or religious cultures together, that's a recipe for disaster. That's not necessarily what you find. So give us an idea of how you're different than Huntington and what you found.
Yeah, the way we are very different than Huntington, we acknowledge that if you look around the globe or look even within countries, in the ones that have more cultural diversity, religious diversity, sometimes these are clearly the very areas where you have flashpoints, where you have sources of conflict. But what we found, it wasn't necessarily this pluralism more these cultural conflicts which were resulting as far as in higher levels of violence, but rather the way the state reacted to this pluralism. So to the extent that both are allowed to coexist without one receiving favoritism or without one receiving being oppressed in some way, that then it neutralizes or it diffuses the potential for the conflict. But what happens quite frequently is when you have these two groups meeting, one is giving more rights or privileges than the other one. So as I mentioned before, quite often Pentecostal Christians do not receive the same rights as perhaps their Muslim neighbors and are openly persecuted. In the Soviet Union, in Russia, there are many places where Muslims are not given the same privilege as a Russian Orthodox Church. And so it's not simply that you have these diversity of groups, but it's that the diversity of groups are treated differentially, and one is given favoritism over another one, which inevitably results in higher levels of conflict.
Which really emphasizes the whole importance of a level playing field and religious liberty. And in fact, in some of the most pluralistic societies, you mentioned the United States, tensions are fairly low, and where every group is essentially a minority religion, each of the minority religions understands that they have to support the other minority, and that actually leads to very positive and, in many cases, ecumenical relations.
That's right. And, you know, people forget this, but early, or I should say probably mid to late 19th century, there was a great potential for it to be major conflicts between Catholics and Protestants. And obviously the tension remained even up to the time when Kennedy was elected in 1960. But what helped to neutralize much of this potential for conflict was the fact that as long as they each had the right to worship freely, and also they tried to convert Catholics, tried to convert Protestants over, and Protestants tried to convert Catholics over, they were all on that on level playing field, as you describe it. And that made all the difference in the world.
One of the cases that really highlights this case very well is the case of Japan. And yeah, you have a significant portion of your book devoted to that. Tell us what went on in Japan over the past, say, 100 years or so that really emphasizes the points you're making here.
Yeah, you know what, as I mentioned earlier, you know, in China, when Falun Gong, you know, had this silent protest as far as the extreme reaction which occurred, and literally over 100,000 were sent to re-education camps. In Japan, by contrast, I want to take up an event there, but first a little bit of the history of Japan. In 1945, after the war, their new constitution guaranteed religious freedoms, and religious freedoms that were then enforced. They weren't in name only. And so as a result, Japan currently is a country that went from one where they have a state religion and everyone had to acknowledge the state religion, and there were very sharp restrictions on minority religions, and then almost overnight they went to one where any religion was allowed to exist and there was complete religious freedom, and there were few restrictions on religions. The result was you had what was often described as the rush hour of the gods. It was said they arose like mushrooms after a rainfall, with all these new different religions arising. And it's not necessarily that Japan became a highly religious nation, which they didn't, but you see this freedom of all these new religions to exist. And what you also see more recently is you see as far as that they are able to diffuse potential conflicts with religions. The most extreme case was the case of a relatively small religious group called the Aum, when they released sarin, or a poisonous gas, on the subways in Japan. And their attempt was to kill many people. They did kill some people, but not as many, fortunately, because it wasn't a pure form of sarin gas that was released. But what was interesting with this was both what the Japanese government did and what they didn't do after that occurred. I mean, on the one hand, they took all the immediate actions of arresting the people involved, of taking action even against the Aum group, more closely monitoring the group because they were a potential threat, and they authorized the closer surveillance even after that did occur. But what they didn't do was they didn't suddenly start restricting all religious groups as a whole. They didn't arrest all members of the group, only those that were involved in the activity or they could trace back to any involvement whatsoever. And most importantly, they didn't pass general laws, which then resulted in it denying some freedoms of other religious groups. Now, by contrast, in China, it was a much less threatening event, but you see, not only did they go after many members of Falun Gong, but they also had increased the restrictions placed on other religions around the country during that time, and it became a very tense time between the state government and the religious groups. So a very, very different reaction. Likewise, you could contrast it with what occurred in France after the Order of Solar Temple, where there's so many suicides were committed there. Instead of overreacting and trying to bring greater regulation to a large number of religions, in the case of Japan, they simply took action on the group involved.
And that's just a benefit of having that religious liberty in place and being able to deal with it on a case-by-case and more level playing field type of instance. Yeah. One of the cases that you put in contrast to this in the same chapter is Nigeria. Tell us what's going on in Nigeria and how that also emphasizes what the case that you're making here.
Yeah, well, you know, in Nigeria, it becomes a more complex situation. And this one, I have to be honest, it's been a couple of years since I worked on this, I haven't read that section of the book or worked on it for a long time. But the things become much more brokered, and it's much more with some structure occurring. And as far as where they try to give control to religious groups based on areas, where they try to give religious control to religious groups as far as by community structure, it becomes a very awkward situation as far as where you have some liberties and groups are given the freedoms to exist, but then you have within certain areas you have high levels of restrictions too.
Mm-hmm. And it does have this effect when I was reading that section of. The idea to the possibility of conflict is to separate everybody out. And so the Muslims tend to have the north now, and the Christians tend to have the south. And with increasing Christian and Pentecostal growth in the area, it's just leading to more tension because you're asking people to literally separate themselves out from one another.
That's right. It's again, you know, if we take it back to racial situations where they felt if we just keep them people separated, it would work out. But in fact, it resulted even in even more tensions, and that same thing is occurring in Nigeria, where you have these such clear separations occurring, different institutional structures supporting them, and then as a result, you have people organized and ready essentially to go against each other, and it becomes a much more dangerous situation that way.
You provide a number of other examples in the book, and we're not going to have time to address all those, so I want to point people in the direction to your book, The Price of Freedom Denied, and we'll put a link up to it on our website. You talk about China, which we've talked a lot about here, but also India and Iran. One of the last chapters in your book, you take on the issue of Islamic societies.
Yeah.
And this is one, it's a very hot button topic in the
right.
news right now, and it also tends to create extreme opinions on either side of the issue. What you do, which I think is beautiful in the book, is to just use the data to tell us what is going on, and in terms of the challenges facing Islamic nations with regard to religious liberty, as well as to the issue of religious persecution that, as we've argued throughout this podcast, that religious violations of religious liberty often give rise to. Speak to us a little bit about that chapter.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I mean, as most people would expect, the overall level of religious freedoms would be less in countries that are predominantly Muslim, and the overall levels of persecution would be substantially higher in countries that are predominantly Muslim. However, it's not something which we're going to assign simply the result of being Muslim, or it's an immediate consequence of the religion.
Right, it's not inherent in the religion, right?
Yeah, it's not inherent to the religion. And so what we tried to understand was, you know, what is going on in these particular societies, which results or lends itself to higher levels, to fewer freedoms and higher levels of religious persecution. There's several things involved, but one that we have to acknowledge right off is much of the lack of freedom and the persecution occurs between Islamic groups. Some people treat this as simply between, as far as all against the West,
right,
and all against Christianity. Much of what's going on is competition between these religious groups. And what they're often in competition for is their version of what an Islamic society should look like, or if it should even be considered an Islamic society. There are many different versions of Sharia law, and so quite often you will have certain social movements that are pushing hard as far as for a more conservative version of both the way Sharia law is interpreted and as far as the specific Islamic sect, which is in power. And all of this results in much more conflict across the religious boundaries. And then because they are often, once they come into power, you have a very close bond as far as between both state and that religion. Then you have what we were talking about before, where they form this alliance, and now they're going to be more likely to persecute other minority religions, because those are the out religions now.
Right.
And so you see these very strong consequences occurring, and then what probably even accentuates this even more is then if you have a strict interpretation of Sharia law, then that is going to interpret more in favor for the dominant religion in power. So you have all these factors entering in that it's not something inherent only to the beliefs, although it certainly can be interpreted that way, you know, by some. But it's clearly some structural things, the way things get set up, and it's the ongoing conflicts for power which inevitably lead to alliances being formed between a specific sect of religion and the group in power at the time.
I think that's a very important lesson, because in the West and here in the United States, there's often a tendency to see Islam as a monolithic entity, that it's just like the Catholic Church with, you know, very hierarchical organization, but it really isn't, and there's a lot of turmoil and ferment within Islam itself, as you mentioned, and the competition between these groups often has what I might consider collateral consequences for other groups in society.
Now, it's a good way of putting it. They often refer to, you know, as far as the Jews were often collateral damage during some of the Christian-Muslim conflicts, and they clearly were.
Right.
In the same way, as you look within some of these Islamic countries, quite often Christian groups, Baha'i, other groups are collateral damage between some Islamic sects within those countries as well, too. And I'd also say that your point as far as on the diversity of Islam is really important, especially when you look at Sunnis. It's extremely diverse there.
Yeah, something we need to keep in mind as we formulate foreign policy and our understandings of different parts of the world. I want to conclude here giving you a moment to talk about what you have done as a service to academia. And we've talked about this before in a podcast with Chris Bader, who you work closely with, but that is something known as the ARDA, and that is known as the Association of Religion Data Archives, which you maintain out of Penn State, I believe, or is it its own separate organization?
It is out of Penn State.
Okay.
Yeah.
And again, what we see in the book that you've written here is this enormous effort to collate and code all these different sources of information into one single database. You've not only done that with Religious Liberty and for use in your own book, but you've done this with every other religious database that you can get your paws onto, and have created a website which is not only useful for academics. I can go find a variety of different data sets to download, but also for the general public at large. So tell us a little bit about what the ARDA is and how it could be useful to folks out there in our general listening audience.
Yeah, the ARDA is something that began simply as a data archive, which sounds extremely boring.
Yeah.
And it was something that was mainly for academics. So we've collected up over, you know, 600 different data collections now. But what I think the exciting part now is that people can come online, and we have things like quick stats or quick lists where they can try to find out, you know, what are the countries that have the highest percent Muslim, the most Muslims? What are the countries that were the most Catholics, highest number of Catholics? And with a number of things, be quite surprised. They can go to each individual country or each individual region, and they can get religious profiles, profiles on religious freedom. They can get survey results from any of these countries. They can really get a wide range of information that way. And then for people who are not really interested in the international arena, they can simply type in their own zip code, and they can get information on the religious profile within their own county.
Mm-hmm.
We now have something up called GIS Maps, which allows them to type in a zip code or to draw an area, put an address in, and you can zoom in and see exactly where every congregation in the neighborhood is located.
Mm-hmm.
You can do a report, and you can find out the demographic profile of your neighborhood, what percent are living under poverty, on and on. So what we've tried to do is, instead of simply having an archive with a lot of data, what we've tried to do is make it so that people can look into this trove of information, and it's much more transparent to see what's going on.
And it's actually very fun, too. My parents, who listen to this podcast because they have to, they're my parents.
They're good parents.
They're good parents. Yeah. They're not very technologically equipped in that, but when they heard about the ARDA on our podcast with Chris Bader, they went to the website. And again, my mom and dad are not really familiar with computers, but they found it incredibly easy to use and had a lot of fun on the website.
Good.
Because you can do a lot of different cross tabs and again, that sounds very statistical and scary, but it's really easy to use. And for anybody not familiar with this, and for students in college or high school or homeschoolers, it's a great way to lead you into statistical knowledge of different things in a very user-friendly way. It's a great resource.
It's fun even to try to understand sort of the heritage of different religious groups if you want to as well. We have little trees and maps they can look at that way.
Yeah.
If you want to compare some of these denominations, you know, what is it, you know, whatever the Methodists really believe or the Assemblies of God really believe, you know, we have a feature where you can compare these different denominations and how they've answered to different surveys on questions about whatever it might be, abortion, you know, belief in literal interpretation of the Bible. And so what we try to do, and we are constantly talking to people to find out what they want, we try to bring the information that we find is of greatest interest to them and then present it in a way that they can get it with a couple clicks. And that's what our really goal is just with two or three clicks that you can get the information you want.
It's a great one-stop shopping for all your religious information resources.
That's right.
And I want to thank you for doing that. I also want to thank you for being on our podcast today.
You're very welcome.
It's been a great time having you on. Really appreciate your work and what you've done. I also want to mention to our listening audience that if you are a homeschooler, if you are a college student, and you are using these podcasts, or a professor, please write to me so I know that how these podcasts are being used. And also, please send me back information on how you think we can improve the podcast for better use. Because again, this is a free service that we provide out of Baylor's Institute for the Studies of Religion, and we want to make this as accessible to as wide audience as possible. And so once again, we were talking with Roger Finke, the author of The Price of Freedom Denied. Roger, once again, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.